The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, contributing editor of the Trumpet Magazine, standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. And today I get to come to you at the start of this program with breaking news, so hot off the press that it didn't even make it into our top of the hour news bulletin yet. Here in Britain, we're going to be having another election. It's coming up now in just 51 days on June 8th, and it was announced just an hour or two ago. So what's going on here? Why a new election? Does this mean that we're getting a new prime minister or that Theresa May is standing again? Well, she is standing again. We're going to, most likely she'll win. We'll stick with her. So to understand what is going on here, why we're having another election now, here's a clip from Theresa May's speech announcing the holding of this new vote.
At this moment of enormous national significance, there should be unity here in Westminster. But instead, there is division. The country is coming together, but Westminster is not. Our opponents believe, because the government's majority is so small, that our resolve will weaken and that they can force us to change course. They are wrong. They underestimate our determination to get the job done. And I am not prepared to let them endanger the security of millions of working people across the country. Because what they are doing jeopardizes the work we must do to prepare for Brexit at home. And it weakens the government's negotiating position in Europe. If we do not hold a general election now, their political game playing will continue. And the negotiations with the European Union will reach their most difficult stage in the run-up to the next scheduled election. Division in Westminster will risk our ability to make a success of Brexit, and it will cause damaging uncertainty and instability to the country. So we need a general election, and we need one now, because we have at this moment a one-off chance to get this done while the European Union agrees its negotiating position and before the detailed talks begin. I have only recently and reluctantly come to this conclusion. Since I became Prime Minister, I have said that there should be no election until 2020. But now I have concluded that the only way to guarantee certainty and stability for the years ahead is to hold this election and seek your support for the decisions I must take. And so tomorrow, I will move a motion in the House of Commons calling for a general election to be held on the 8th of June.
I think it's interesting in that clip how she mentions division a lot. Now, we've talked about this a fair bit when discussing Brexit, how bitterly divided the UK is on this subject. And, well, an election, it may well lead to a stronger government, but elections tend to make divisions worse, not better, and just holding an election is not going to solve the problem of division. But what is going on here? Well, the problem is that Ms. May, she has a working majority of about 17. There are different, slightly different ways of counting majority, and that makes her life quite a bit harder. It's only a small majority, so if a reasonable number of Conservatives vote against her, well, then she can be blocked if they ally with the other parties. And that gives her much less room to manoeuvre. It's not hard to imagine that many Conservative MPs saying, well, actually, we want to remain in the European Union and siding against Ms. May and with the opposition parties in EU-related votes. There's still quite a large number of Conservative MPs that are pro-European Union. And a lot of Conservative MPs voted to stay within the European Union. Also, at the other end, you could easily see 10, 20 very hardcore anti-European MPs voting against a bill that they think is too soft of a Brexit, that does not have Britain leaving the EU enough and getting out of enough European-related activities. And you could see them perhaps siding with opposition MPs and trying to block that. Now, if Ms. Merkel or Ms. May had a much larger majority, she would be in a much stronger position in negotiating. It would be much harder for other parties to derail Brexit. She'd be able to go to the European Union with a stronger hand. The European Union would have less leeway to try and work with, say, the Labour Party or the Liberal Democrat Party and just kind of try and play games with British politics. So it looks like that's what she's after. And meanwhile, the Labour Party have kind of handed her a golden opportunity. Jeremy Corbyn, basically Britain's Bernie Sanders, he is the leader of Britain's Labour Party and, well, he's every bit as useless as the term Britain's Bernie Sanders suggests that he would be. He is incredibly unpopular. Labour is losing in places that they've held since they were just about founded as a party. And so Ms. May is hoping to take advantage of this historic weakness in the Labour Party to scoop up a bunch more seats, gain a large majority, and then be in a much better position. It looks like people have been analysing the polls, and if elections were to be held today, based on current opinion polls, she would have a majority of about 112. So going from a majority of 17 to a majority of 112, an unassailable majority, one where she wouldn't have to worry about a handful or even a couple of dozen Conservative MPs voting against her, would put her in a much stronger position. And so those polls suggest that basically about 50 seats that used to go to Labour would turn to go to Conservatives. Now, opinion polls have been problematic of late, to say the least. But that's what they indicate at the moment. And then also, remember, Theresa May took over as Prime Minister after David Cameron stepped down. She's not won an election herself. And so by going and holding an election, winning her election, it would improve her own personal mandate. And I don't think that's why she's doing it, but it's kind of another side benefit for her. So how does this work? Well, basically, Parliament can decide to hold an election whenever it wants. That was made a bit more difficult a few years ago by the Fixed-Term Parliament Act, and that says that the Prime Minister needs a two-thirds majority in order to call an early election. However, the Fixed-Term Parliament Act is pretty much useless, because even if she couldn't get that two-thirds majority, she could just repeal the Fixed-Term Parliament Act and then hold an election with a simple majority. So all that's required for an election is a majority, basically, and so she's going to be able to get that. There's going to be a new election on June 8th. Now, there's still an element of risk, of course. You never know exactly how things are going to turn out. There's still a potential for a lot to happen within 51 days. I mean, look at the pace of terrorist attacks even that we've seen with the bus bombing in Germany, which I guess that's looking more and more like that might have been the work of far-right groups rather than Islamists. Then you had the attack in Sweden the week before, attack in St. Petersburg earlier that week, the attack on Coptic Christians in Egypt. So with so many events going on, there's still a lot of uncertainty. So we'll have to see how that turns out. But that's the kind of the big breaking news in Britain right now. Now, apart from that, when I was looking at the news this morning, the news sites, at least the ones I check, seem to be absolutely dominated by just three stories that take up just about all of their, or almost all of their column inches. Three potentially huge news stories, ones that could be real turning points in world events. One of these is the tensions in North Korea, with Kim Jong-un saying, well, we're going to do a nuclear test, or we're going to launch a missile, I think it was, every week now. The other is the French elections, and I spoke about that a bit on Trumpet Hour, and I will probably get to that later as those elections come up. There's the potential for a real upset. In Europe, you've got the potential for either the far left or the far right to win, groups that want France out of the euro, things that would just absolutely bring down the euro, cause major crisis within the European Union. And then these elections are just exposing the fact that you have now 40-50% of people in France or in Italy that think that want out of the euro. So this is showing that Europe is building to a major crisis. that people in the heart of Europe no longer want to be in the euro. And that's going to provoke some major changes sooner or later. But it's the third big story that I want to talk about today, because this is really, it's a big event that's happened rather than something that's coming up. And it's something we've not had a chance to talk about yet on this show. And that is Turkey's constitutional referendum on Sunday. Another huge event. Now, Turkey is literally one of the most pivotal countries in the world. It stands at that great pivot point between Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. It's at that vital crossroads between Europe and the Middle East. And actually, we want a quick quote that we'll hear from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, just describing the vital importance of Turkey, which, of course, as many of you probably know, is referred to as Edom in the Bible.
God says in Obadiah 13 and 14, this book about Esau, or Turkey, as well as some spiritual Edomites, or spiritual people with that Esau attitude. But it says that there that Turkey is at the crossway. What does that mean? Well, it means the crossroads of the world. We have to look at this geopolitically and try to get the vision here of what it means. This is a giant gate, sea gate, in the Bosphorus at the north of Turkey and the Dardanelles at the south of Turkey, and especially controlled by European Turkey. And look, you have to understand what this all means. If you don't have these gateways, and if you don't have, for example, if Russia, after winning all that power in World War II, was not able to come through the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles out into the Mediterranean world trade, they could never have sustained their world power. It's about world power. And that is something we don't seem to understand in America and Britain. Britain has already lost out in that part of the world. They used to control that part of the world, and that's when they were a world power. But they've lost it and all that power with it. And America is going the same direction. And it's almost there. How much influence do you think we have in that part? How much geopolitical influence, let's say, do we have in the crossroads of the world and in the Middle East and that surrounding area? How much influence does America have? It's all about world power. You need to read the history books and realize that if you lose out in that area, you lose everything. Or potentially so, anyhow. That's a critical sea gate of this world, and it is controlled right now by Turkey, but only because the U.S. has backed and supported them and kept it from Russia. They would have taken it if we hadn't helped Turkey. But again, you can have all kinds of space age power and jet planes and all of that, all kinds of technology and airplanes. But look, it's still about world trade, which is transported mainly by ships as we get those raw materials and minerals from the soil. They have to be shipped mainly by large ships. And that's where the Seagate, that crossroads of the world, comes in. Because all of those goods from Russia flow right through there out into the Mediterranean and around the world. Russia has that warm sea outlet there, and it means everything to their stature in the world and their power in this world. They have a naval base in Syria. Why would they want to be in Syria? Well, because they want to control the crossroads of the world. They want to control the Middle East. They want to put themselves in a position where they can bring down other powers. That's what it's all about. Now, again, Russia, without that, would not be a world power.
crossroads of the world, Mr. Flurry, we heard talking about Turkey there, and just its importance for world power. It's a region that just touches on so many other regions. Eastern Turkey has deep links into the Middle East. It controls the headlands of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, making it a very important power within the Middle East. It's kind of a mountainous stronghold there that's easy to defend, and Turkey can easily project power into that region. As you heard from Mr. Flurry there, it's a gatekeeper for Russia and Russian trade. Russia has no warm water ports unless you're going all the way over out into the Far East. Its ports elsewhere in the European theater freeze over in the winter, and so access via the Black Sea out into the Mediterranean is vital for Russia. And so it touches on Russia and directly affects Russian power in a very dramatic way. And then in Europe, and we've seen that most dramatically with the migrant crisis, how it stands in a gateway to Europe and into the Balkans. And the Ottoman Empire before, for good reason, has reached all the way up onto the border with Austria. So a major and important power there, a crossroads of the world. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about events in Turkey. Events that we need to be watching. So to have such an important power like Turkey, basically, you're kind of up for grabs almost, going through a period of uncertainty where people are saying, well, who's it going to align with? Are they quitting, moving away from America? Are they moving away from Europe? Are they moving into Russia's camp? Are they becoming a Middle Eastern power in their own right? What's happening? And at the heart of all of this uncertainty is their constitutional referendum over the weekend. That's why this is a really important subject for us to watch. So what does this mean? Well, The Economist they started their article again just talking about the importance of this. They said, right, Turkey matters not just for its size, but also as a bellwether of the political forces shaping the world. For centuries, it was the seat of a great empire. Today, as a frontier state, it must cope with the violence spewing out of war-ravaged Syria. It is a test case of whether democracy can be reconciled with political Islam. And it must navigate between Western liberalism and the authoritarian nationalism epitomized by Russia. And so it's a test case for this world as well. It's an important sign of where world events are going. So what does the future hold for Turkey and for the world? Well, this election in Turkey exposes some really important trends that we see around the world. And the first trend that we'll look at is the rise of strongmen. Here's a breakdown from the Wall Street Journal on exactly what was up for election this weekend in that constitutional vote.
Turkey's President Recep Erdogan claimed vast new powers in a referendum Sunday. They include a new executive presidency where he will exercise sole power, the abolition of the post of prime minister, the power to unilaterally appoint vice presidents without parliamentary approval, the power to appoint and dismiss cabinet ministers, again, without parliamentary approval, and the power to select a significant number of judges on high judicial bodies, among many other powers.
So that's a good summary of some of the specifics. So there's an election that concentrates power with one man. Now, to kind of put this in the big picture, here's a CNN interview between Ivan Watson and Henry Bakery from the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Henry, why was this referendum seen as almost an existential moment for Turkey?
Well, look, Turkey is not going to be the same Turkey that we have known all these years. This is not to say that Turkey was the paragon of virtue or democracy, but after this referendum, when it goes into effect, especially in 2019, what you will see is essentially a one-man show. Erdogan is going to control all the levers of power. There will be no divisions of powers in Turkey, separation of powers in Turkey. That is to say, he's going to control the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. And as a result, nothing will happen without his assent or his consent. So in many ways, politics as we know it will die in Turkey. And the reaction, we still don't know how this is going to play out.
So politics as we know it, dying in Turkey. Erdogan cemented as a strongman. The Guardian, they published a piece yesterday afternoon titled Erdogan's Referendum Victory Unsurprising in a strongman world. Now, before we get into that one point, I thought Daniel Pipes just made one important point on this subject where he talked about, well, really, Erdogan had, he was a strong man already, even before this election. He writes, criticism of the almighty president can get even a child thrown into jail. The most tenuous connection to a, brackets, possibly staged coup d'etat attempt last July means losing one's job or worse. The state routinely jails journalists on the bogus charge of terrorism, and truly independent publications are shuttered. So he was already a strong man, already basically a dictator, but this makes it official. And by making it official, it's still a major milestone in the rise of strongmanism, if you like, around the world. So going back to this Guardian article, they wrote, the Turkish vote to give Recep Tayyip Erdogan virtually dictatorial powers seems hard to understand for Europeans accustomed to traditional forms of post-war democratic pluralism. Far from being an aberration, however, Turkey is following a growing trend for autocratic strongman leaders that has echoed around the world. It goes on to write, the end of the Cold War and the Soviet collapse appears to usher in a global era of open, inclusive parliamentary governance. As US president in the 1990s, Bill Clinton often hailed what he believed was democracy's irreversible onward march. So people used to believe, well, that's democracy, you know, it was the end of history. Democracy now is the way things were done, and that we're trending away from strongmen. This article goes on to write, that assessment now looks optimistic. And one obvious reason why he talks about Donald Trump, he tries to pin a lot of this on the rise of Donald Trump, which is quite a bit of a stretch. And I think he ends up tying himself in a few contortions trying to do this. Really, the rise of strongmen long predates Donald Trump. Going back more to Vladimir Putin. Now, I do think America is partly to blame with the rise of strongmen, but more because of a failure to stand up to men like Vladimir Putin, to China, to Iran, to North Korea, to all of these nations that were electing strongmen and that were basically pushing the United States around. And people got the message, well, if you elect a strongman, you can push democracies, even the world's most powerful democracy, the United States, you can push them around if you've got a strongman. And I think it was America's weakness there that really encouraged this rise of strongmen rather than this kind of attempt to malign Donald Trump as being illegitimately elected. But going back to this article, it says Vladimir Putin's system of so-called managed democracy has a lot to answer for. This approach has kept Putin in power in Russia either as prime minister or president since 2000. The way it works is you hold a referendum with an apparent choice, so there's an illusion of democratic process, but the result is decided in advance. Strongman leaders in Angola, Uganda, Zimbabwe, Malaysia, Thailand, Burma, Belarus, Azerbaijan, and in Central Asia and China have all profited from managed democracy. So we talk about some big examples, but countries all around the world have these strong men. Like Putin, they typically augment their electoral confidence tricks by suppressing credible opposition parties, controlling the media, and conjuring up imaginary external threats. In Turkey, as in many other countries, democracy is a relatively recent phenomenon. It is not strongly embedded. Now Erdogan, who rose to power on the back of the country's democratic opening, has cynically uprooted it. So democracy is very fragile, and we see it disappearing in so many countries around the world, in this world of strong men. And this kind of reminds me of a trumpet cover we had back in 2015, where it had a picture of Putin, of Ali Khamenei from Iran, of... I'm trying to think which Chinese leader we had on the cover back then. I guess it would still be the current one. And then a picture of the EU flag with a question mark saying, how can leaderless Europe survive in a world of strongmen? And this is what we're looking at, a world of strongmen. And more nations are realizing this. And it's a trend that is definitely affecting Europe. And we'll have Europe looking and thinking more about their own strong men. Do they need, in a world of strong men, in a world where you have Recep Tayyip Erdogan standing up aggressively for what they believe is good for their nation, or at least good for themselves, do other nations need someone who's got a bit more strength? And you're seeing more and more nations swapping democracies for dictatorships, where just a few years ago, people thought the trend was the other way around, that dictatorships were falling and becoming democracies. It's a trend that's even affecting the United States. There was one survey that found that only 30% of those, that was the World Value Survey in 2014, only 30% of those born in the 1980s said it was essential to live in a democracy. Only 19% said that a military takeover in the case of a government being incompetent or failing to do its job was not legitimate. Only one-third said civil rights are absolutely essential. In 2015, 1 in 6 said they were fine with a military coup, whereas in 1995 that number was 1 in 16. In 2011, a survey found that a quarter of young people thought democracy was bad or very bad. A couple of academics who compiled these statistics in the Journal of Democracy, they wrote, three decades ago, most scholarship assumed the Soviet Union would remain stable. This assumption was suddenly proven false. Today, we have even greater confidence in the durability of the world's affluent, consolidated democracies. But do we have good ground for our democratic self-confidence? What we find is deeply concerning. Citizens in a number of supposedly consolidated democracies in North America and Western Europe have not only grown more critical of their political leaders, rather they've become more cynical about the value of democracy as a political system. And they cover data from across the world. People are rejecting more and more the idea of democracy, and they're starting to think they like the look of strongmen as one possible alternative. A trend around the world. So that's one thing we see reflected in Turkey now with Recep Tayyip Erdogan just really cementing his status there as a strong man. And a second important trend that we're seeing within Turkey is the rise of political Islam. Until recently, Turkey had been a very secular state. The Ottoman Empire, they were devastated by World War One. The empire had been decaying for a long time. But they were able to kind of stay around even though they were in decay because none of the other major powers wanted to break it up because they didn't want their rivals to get any of the pieces. But World War One finally broke it up, and afterwards Kemal Atatürk, he kind of refounded Turkey, setting the foundations for modern Turkey, and he made it secular. He looked at the modern powers in Europe, and they were all secular. So he took the view, well, if Turkey is going to be a major power in the modern world, well, we need to be a secular state, just like Europe is. And Islam in Turkey needs to play a similar role to the role Christianity plays in modern Europe. It's kind of there, and it's the belief of a lot of people, but it's relegated to the private life. And so Turkey has a very different character to a lot of other Middle Eastern powers. He outlawed some of the more traditional headwear and things like that and pushed for this secular state. But Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he's been pushing back at a lot of that. He's a lot more religious than previous leaders. He's much more, he's not afraid to let religion influence the government. He has the backing of those that are much more in favor of political Islam. And so his victory in this referendum is seen as a major victory also for political Islam. George Friedman on Geopolitical Futures, he had an article that's just gone up on this subject. He writes, the referendum in Turkey on Sunday was about increasing the power of the president, but on a deeper level, it was about the relationship between secular and religious segments of society. He said, almost a century after Turkey's foundings, the Kemalist formula, that secular formula we just talked about, has become untenable. The religious in the Muslim world have reasserted themselves in a number of divergent streams. This has inevitably energized the Muslim masses in Turkey. The secular European culture that had dominated the country is confronting the increasingly powerful claims of the religious. The fundamental political and social question is how to create a single polity built around two divergent cultures. Neither can be dismissed. Turkey is a Muslim country that was modernized by secularism. If you destroy the secular, you demolish the accomplishments Turkey has made thus far. If you attack the Muslims, you inflame a religion that, having been aroused, cannot capitulate. Turkey has become a republic of mutual contempt and distrust. Whoever governs Turkey will be riding a tiger. If he falls off, Turkey will be torn apart. If he stays on the tiger, simultaneously secular and Muslim, will have to be afraid of the rider. And that's a good point to some of the deeper reasons why Erdogan has become more dictatorial and authoritarian. And it is easy to look at Turkey and kind of lament the rise of Islam under Erdogan. But this is part of a broader trend, and Erdogan is also a reflection of this broader trend and of this rise of Islamism. And how would Islam in Turkey respond if it did try to get back to secularism? It's an interesting question to think about there. But Friedman writes, the rule of the secularists in Turkey, backed by the army, is over. At the same time, we're seeing a transformation of secularism from a system of toleration that accommodates private beliefs in public life to an attempt to exclude those beliefs from the private sphere. So anyway, the rule of secularists in Turkey, backed by the army, is over. We're moving away now from this, it's an end of an era for Turkey, really. An end of an era. Foreign Policy had an article, again, kind of writing RIP, the secular state of Turkey. Daniel Pipes, he addressed this same trend in an article for the Wall Street Journal titled The Other Islamic State, Erdogan's Vision for Turkey. And he wrote, where will it end? The president has two apparent objectives. First, Mr. Erdogan seeks to reverse Kemal Atatürk's westernizing reforms to reinstitute the Ottoman Empire's Islamic ways. Second, he wants to elevate himself to the grand ancient Islamic position of caliph, an especially vivid prospect since Islamic State resurrected this long moribund position in 2014. And I think he's right that Turkey does have ambitions to be the leader of the Arab world, the Muslim world, and that's something we'll talk about a bit later. But they see themselves as a viable alternative to some of these other powers like Iran or Saudi Arabia, or even the Islamic State, that are trying to present themselves as leader of the Islamic world. These two ambitions, writes Pipes, could meld together exactly 100 years after Atatürk abolished the caliphate, either on March 10th, 2021 by the Islamic calendar or March 4th, 2014 by the Christian calendar. Either of these dates offers a perfect occasion for Mr. Erdogan to undo the handiwork of the secular Atatürk and declare himself caliph of all Muslims. No one inside Turkey can effectively resist Mr. Erdogan's enormous ambitions. This leaves him free to continue in his erratic ways, stirring trouble at home and abroad. That is, unless he one day trips, likely over an external crisis. Meanwhile, Turkey and Turks and millions of others will pay an increasing price for Erdogan's vainglorious rule. Now, this rise of Islam in Turkey, it can be seen by just the stats on the ground. Here's just a few statistics from Robert Kaplan's book, The Revenge of Geography, where you can just really see how Islam has expanded in Turkey dramatically. He writes, in 1945, there were 20,000 mosques in Turkey. 1985, 72,000. And that number has since risen steadily out of proportion to the population. So you can see in the background behind this, Islam has been playing a much more powerful role within Turkey. He writes, according to some studies, almost two-thirds of urban working-class Turks pray daily, as well as most rural Turks, percentages that have gone up in recent years. And he goes on to talk about a revived Islam in Turkey. And this is a trend that we're seeing all around the world. A revival of Islam, but a revival of the role religion is playing across the world. We see that in Turkey. We see that in other places. Samuel Huntington, in his book Clash of Civilizations, he wrote that the late 20th century has seen a global resurgence of religions around the world. And he wrote that in 1997, and we've only seen more evidence since then. He was writing that before you'd had the 9/11 attacks and Islam, radical Muslim Islam becoming just a feature of our daily news. He goes to cite a lot of these stats worldwide, and he writes that the radical fundamentalists are only the surface wave of a much broader, more fundamental religious tide. He writes that in 1989, Central Asia had only 160 active mosques. Oh, these are just some of the stats. And then 4 years later, 10,000. Russia in 1988, 50 churches. 1993, 250. Around that same time, that nearly a third of Russians under the age of 25 said they'd switched from being atheist to believing in God. China is still officially atheist. They've had, though, the number of followers of all religions, according to the World Religion Database, go from about 300 million in 1970 to 700 million today. And again, that's growing much faster than China's population is growing. And this is despite the government trying to stop it. And I saw a headline just today about the officially atheist government's attempts to stamp religion and stop this rise of religion. But they've not been able to. South Korea, 1962, 2.6% of the population Buddhist, 5% Christian. Now 23% Buddhist, 29% Christian. Jean-Marc Ledger, president of the Wind-Gallup International Association, he did a global poll in 2014, and after that he wrote, "Religion continues to dominate our everyday lives, and we see that the total number of people who consider themselves to be religious is actually relatively high. Furthermore, with the trend of an increasingly religious youth globally, we can assume the number of people who consider themselves religious will only continue to increase." And it was just Western Europe and Oceania. They were the only two regions in the world where about half of the population were either atheist or not religious. But across the world, instead of becoming increasingly secular, they're becoming increasingly more religious. And Huntington, he wrote, "In the modern world, religion is a central, perhaps the central force that motivates and mobilizes people." So again, this is something we're seeing, just like with the rise of strongmanism, the rise of religion is something we see in Turkey that is a reflection of events all around the world, not just in the Middle East. And it's again something that we can expect to follow in Europe. And you're seeing that already with the French election, where, for example, over the weekend, François Fillon, instead of holding a rally, he was addressing Catholic voters. And Marine Le Pen is trying to do a lot to reach out to Catholics as well. And we can expect religion to play a much greater role in Europe's politics too soon. That's really a subject for another day, but it's a trend we see reflected in Turkey. And what I think is really interesting here is we could see the rise, or be seeing the rise, of a new model of political Islam in Turkey. And religion, it's a powerful tool for a nation to reach out beyond its borders. Daniel Pipes already alluded to that with his speculation that Erdogan would declare himself caliph. But he's definitely spot on in this idea of Erdogan trying to use religion to reach beyond Turkey's borders, to put itself forward as a leader of all of Islam in the Middle East. You see Saudi Arabia doing the same thing. You see Iran doing that. And there's some interesting potentials there we'll get to a little bit later. Another important point in what this says about the religious views of Turks is also, if you look at the way Turks voted in Europe. We talked about this earlier on the show about how many Turks live in places like Germany and then in the Netherlands. And some, like in the UK, are actually pretty secular. In the UK, 80% voted no to the referendum. However, in the Netherlands, 70% voted yes. 63% in Germany voted yes. So you've got around two-thirds of Turks in these countries voting for Erdogan. And remember, ahead of the referendum, the German governments, the Dutch governments, they strongly opposed Erdogan on it. They refused to allow rallies. The Netherlands even refused to let Turkish ministers enter the country. It escalated to the point you had Turks sending home Dutch cows. But then when it came to a showdown between Erdogan and their home governments, for so many of those Turks living in Europe, living especially in Germany and the Netherlands, they sided with Erdogan. When it came to this competition between European secularism and Islam, these people that live in overwhelmingly secular Western states and have for several generations in a lot of cases, well, I guess there'd be the more recent migrants voting in these elections, but they chose to side with Erdogan and with Islam. So it does show a fundamental divide here between Muslims and the states they live in. Not that these are going to become suicide bombers or carry out terrorist attacks at all, but it shows that there's just a fundamentally different way of thinking that's going to cause an increasing amount of friction. And we already saw that friction play a major role in the Dutch elections, and that friction with Turkey especially. And it can affect Germany too. Deutsche Welle had an article today where they wrote that this figure, this 63% voting yes, ought to be a wake-up call for Germany. The fact that only 50% actually voted, or that in other countries such as Austria, approval for the Erdogan camp was even higher, is irrelevant. If so many people living in Germany support a man who wants, among other things, to reintroduce the death penalty, then all attempts at integration notwithstanding, things have gone very wrong somewhere. And that's what Germany's looking at and saying, well, things have gone very wrong in our relations with Islam, in importing all of these millions of Turkish workers. And that's something that's going to cause a lot of friction. So a couple of trends that we see from Turkey that are a reflection of things going on around the world, the rise of strongmanism and the rising role of Islam in politics. We'll take a quick break and then we'll look a bit more after the break at the future of Turkey.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've been talking about Turkey and their constitutional reforms. And what I want to move on now is looking at the future of Turkey, and especially the future of Turkey's relationship with Europe. This is a very important question, one in both terms of geopolitically and thinking long term, but also in the short term, with questions like, well, how will the migrant crisis play out? What will the summer be like for illegal immigration into Europe? How will that affect the German election coming up in September? But for those of you who are familiar with our message, you know that you probably know that we've made around two or three just really core predictions about Turkey, and especially about Turkey and the European Union. The first is that Turkey won't join the European Union. There have been a lot of pushes for Turkey to join the European Union or to be pushed on the put on the path to European membership. And we've said all along, well, when you look at the heritage of the European Union, it's a Christian club. It's been strongly promoted by the Catholic Church. Turkey is fundamentally, even despite the secular reforms, it's a Muslim civilization. They're not going to allow it to join. And so it hasn't so far. And this has been one of the big takeaways that a lot of people have taken from this constitutional referendum. You know, they've been saying, well, you know, before it looked unlikely that Turkey would join the EU. But any hopes of that, they're now definitely dead after Sunday's referendum. Europe would never let this type of a Turkey join. You know, not the least, Erdogan has said that he wanted to bring back the death penalty. And that is an absolute, I think, black and white part of EU law. You can't join the European Union if you have the death penalty. And so this is something we've been saying for years. For example, here's what Mr. Flurry wrote in a 1998 article called The Last Crusade. He said that Turkey, just north of Cyprus, has been a strong member of NATO for many years, yet a German-led European Union has rejected it from joining the EU, even though it has been applying since 1963, when there are only six members. 21 new countries have joined since then, but that number is set to about to be reduced dramatically. Why has the EU consistently rejected Turkey? Is it because Turkey is predominantly Islamic? The EU is prophesied to be ultimately comprised of 10 kings ruling 10 nations or groups of nations dominated by Catholicism. Already the EU is being called the Holy Roman Empire. It has traditionally been the enemy of the Muslims. So it comes from out of that heritage of Christendom. And so they've not allowed Turkey to join, exactly as Mr. Flurry said would happen. But another very important prediction, very specific prediction that comes right out of the Bible that we've made about Turkey, is that they would be an important ally of Europe. And here's what Mr. Flurry said in a different Key of David show, talking about Turkey's relationship here about with Europe and also with Iran.
But Turkey, again, has been allied with Iran. But why would they be siding up to Germany? Well, because they disagree with Iran in this revolution that's going on. They're behind and support the rebels, while Iran supports the Assad regime. So there, it looks like there's problems between Turkey and Iran. And of course, we know there's going to be, because Turkey's going to be allied with Germany. And Germany is driving a wedge between those two great countries, Turkey and Iran. What does that mean to people in this world? Well, it means very little, because they don't know what's going on. But God prophesied all of it and spells it out and says, if we'll just study our Bibles, we can understand that. we must understand it. God has His little treasured ones or sheltered ones there because He protects them, and they understand it. Do you understand this? We really do need to. Well, you watch what happens in with Turkey and Germany and all of these other nations. Just watch and see what happens and see if they don't break away from Iran. And after Germany defeats Iran, then they're all going to already virtually be allied with Germany. You see, those things don't happen overnight. It takes time. And Germany has been laying that groundwork for many years. And that you can prove from your world news. It's just that it flies under the radar most of the time. People don't realize what's really happening, but we're talking about a massive shift in nations of this world and events that are going to just stagger the imagination of many authorities in this world. And God had it all planned out long ago, or prophesied long ago. He let others do a lot of the planning.
So back when Mr. Flory was talking about that, Turkey was kind of moving closer towards Iran, kind of in the same way that Turkey has been moving closer to Russia in recent times. And he said, well, there's going to be a massive shift and they're going to end up allied with Germany. And when we post this radio show online, we'll link to a couple of articles up on that, the card on the front page that you can read, just proving and going over in more detail what the Bible says about Turkey. But Turkey is singled out in Bible prophecy as a major partner for Europe. Not part of the European Union, not part of the 10-nation superpower that the Bible prophesies that is coming, but allied with it, aligned with it. And that's what we can watch out for when it comes to Turkey's future. And there's a lot of question marks right now with this referendum, which Europe has not liked the result of. And at the same time, Turkey moving closer to Russia, moving closer to Vladimir Putin. Well, people have been saying, well, who are they going to end up with? I think just based on history and geography, you can conclude that a Russian-Turkish alliance has to be, or any Russian-Turkish alliance has to be short-lived. I can't really think of any or many, or at least any times where they've been on the same side, really. They do tend to be rivals because, well, they're so close that Russia is always going to be a threat to Turkey. And then, you know, they have that sea gate that Russia so desperately needs if they're going to move down there into the Mediterranean. And so Turkey just about always ends up fearing Russia, seeking outside help to guarantee that Russia doesn't get that sea gate if they're not powerful enough to defend it themselves. So ultimately, I think Russia, they're too strong, too near for Turkey to really rely on, whereas the United States has been somebody that's much further away, but also strong that they can rely on and not have the same fear that they're going to try and take over those sea gates. So a temporary alignment is really the most that we can hope for that you could see from Turkey's relationship with Russia, not a long-term matching of interests. And I said that, well, obviously that comes out of Bible prophecy, but that comes just out of history, out of geography as well. And there are a few ways that this alliance with Europe could play out now in this post-constitution Turkey. I mean, we could see a change of course, potentially. There's still the potential for that away from Erdogan. That election was much closer than Erdogan was hoping for. I think it was somewhere just over 51% voted for these constitutional reforms. He was hoping for something over 55%, something much more decisive. And that 51%, or just over 51%, that's still with Erdogan locking up journalists that he doesn't like. That's still with even some quite credible accusations of voter fraud. And Istanbul, which is a major, in many ways, Turkey's most important city. They're not the capital, but in Istanbul, they voted against these reforms. And Erdogan used to be mayor there, but they voted against them. This nation is very bitterly divided, like we talked about. You've got those urban secularists, and then you've got the rural religious. And with this strong opposition within those urban secularists, and with him not having the support, as much support that he wanted for these reforms, it is possible that he could fall in some fashion. As Friedman says, he is riding a tiger, and that is going to inevitably be unstable. So you could see a turn away from Erdogan being one way that you could see Europe being this alliance with Europe just increasing. But at the same time, I certainly wouldn't write off Erdogan's relationship with Europe. I think there certainly could be some rocky times ahead, especially in the short term, with the way that Turkey is closing up to Russia, with and with this vote that a lot of Europe didn't like, and it's caused a lot of bad blood. And Erdogan has made quite a few statements against the Netherlands, against Germany, and they're all kind of upset with each other. They're not best buddies right now. But I wouldn't write it off in the long term. I mean, one very important aspect is that Turkey is very short on cash and Europe is by far its richest neighbor. So that provides a strong incentive to get along and to increase trade ties and this kind of thing. I think fear of Russia is ultimately another very strong push there. But this new, more Islamist Turkey, I think it could also provide Europe with a stepping stone into the Middle East. One of the things Mr. Flory was talking about on that Key of David we played a clip from was an alliance between Europe and a set of Muslim powers, an alliance that's talked about in Psalm 83. And a Turkey that moves in the direction of Islam, while it could have a more active involvement in other Muslim countries and could actually make a more effective bridge between Europe and Islam. And Turkey, even it's had that secular history and moving towards Islam, just like Europe is secular these days at the moment. And then it's just that physical bridge between Europe and the Middle East. And so it could provide a more effective bridge for that alliance. After all, that even if you go back to the kind of Ottoman Turkish version of Islam before Kemal Atatürk, it's one that's more used to dealing with Christian Europe. Even going back to the heyday of the height of the Ottoman Empire, it cooperated strongly with Venice to lock down much of the spice trade and the trade with Asia. To quote a bit more from Kaplan's book, he talks in this book about, he said, the eclectic nature of Turkish Islam goes together with Turkey's very westernization. He also talks about how it's got a middle class that's not kind of created by oil revenue. There's some more stability there. It was the Ottoman Empire, he writes, that played a large role in bringing European politics, at least the Balkan variety of it, into intimate contact with that of the Middle East. In the early 21st century, Turkey boasts a vibrant and politically dominant Islamic movement, an immense military capability compared to almost any country in the Middle East save Israel, an economy that has grown 8% annually for many years and still managed over 5% growth during the worldwide recession, and a dam system that made Turkey a water power to the same extent that Iran and Saudi Arabia were oil powers. These factors, seen and unseen, allow Turkey to compete with Iran for the locus of Islamic leadership and legitimacy. So they can be a competitor for Iran, a viable alternative for Iran when it comes to Europe trying to build an anti-Islam alliance with these nations that share their fear and suspicion of radical Islam as led by Iran. Kaplan, he goes on to write that Turkey's aggressive rise as a Middle Eastern power for the first time since the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. He says, with that, Iran will have a competition from next door, for Turkey can at once be Iran's friend and competitor. He says, as difficult as it has become for the West to tolerate Turkey's Islamist leadership still represents a vast improvement over the mindset of the Iranian clerical government. Turkey can act as a mediator between Israel and Muslim. Well, I'll leave it there. But this spread of a Turkish version of Islam and this rise of Turkey as a leading Muslim power in the Middle East rather than a secular power, on the one hand, Europe is not best pleased to see Turkey become more Islamist. But compared to Iran, Turkish Islam is a much more palatable partner for Europe, one they might work with to a certain extent, and that might make them an even more effective partner going forward in creating this alliance that we've been watching for from Bible prophecy. Now, there's one final prophecy that we've been watching about Turkey, and that is that the Bible prophesies that Turkey will turn against Israel, Britain, and America. And Mr. Hilliker, in an article a few years ago, he writes about the description of these events, reveals several things that illuminate the meaning of present-day headlines. He goes over some of what the Bible says will happen. And he says, well, if you look at what the Bible says, well, we can expect then that Turkey's alliance with the US and Israel will remain, at least in name, because to betray Israel and Britain and America, well, it would have to, they'd have to look, these nations would have to look on Turkey as a friend. So for them to turn around and betray them, it implies that that friendship is still there in name, at least. But at the same time, this betrayal may mean we can expect more friction to develop within this alliance. And that's proven absolutely right. More friction has been developing. And so you can see the seed sown for a Turkey that turns against America, Britain, Israel in the Middle East. And you can definitely see that happening as Islam rises and becomes stronger in Turkey with the rise of and power of Erdogan. It's setting presaging that betrayal as well. And you can see that building. Turkey, then, is vital for us to watch. It's a key pivot point, a crossroads in the world. We don't know exactly where it's going in the short term, but the Bible gives us some incredibly specific things to watch for in the long term. So watch Turkey. This is an excellent opportunity to watch Bible prophecy and see it come true. Now, you don't want to fall into the trap of just watching and not actually doing anything until it's too late, but watch these specific prophecies that we've talked about being fulfilled in Turkey. That's about it from me. As I said, we'll post more links on the front page with articles that you can look at that give you more background on what we've talked about, so you can study this for yourself, prove more for yourself what the Bible says about Turkey. This is Stephen Flourish. Be back next week, so tune in then for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.